Good morning to council. Next case on our calendar today is A24-10129, State of Minnesota versus Fawaz Mohammed Aboukar. You can take a minute to get settled there. Council will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and council for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, as you're aware. Please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument, as we are recording the arguments here today. So with that, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Your honors, good morning. My name is John Munnins and I represent Fawaz Aboukar in today's case. Because the district court committed structural error when it closed the courtroom, not allowing anyone to enter or leave for nearly half of Mr. Aboukar's trial, we respectfully request that this court reverse his convictions and grant him a new trial. Alternatively, if that remedy is not granted, we do ask that this court remand for resentencing so that Mr. Aboukar can be sentenced with the proper criminal history score, which would be 4 when he is sentenced on the final count, count 2, because the district court erred when it Hernandized every count for which he was convicted prior to sentencing. In this case, on day 2 of trial, the court ordered sua sponte that no person would be allowed to enter or leave the courtroom during the course of the trial. They would only be allowed to do that during the regularly scheduled breaks, be the morning, lunch, and then the mid-morning and mid-afternoon break.
We say morning, lunch, and mid-morning. Are you saying there's 2 morning breaks or just 1 mid-morning break?
1 mid-morning break, but people could show up in the morning.
Oh, the morning, got it.
Correct.
So there's 4 entry points.
Correct.
Right.
You'd have to show up either first thing in the morning, during the mid-morning break, sometime over the lunch break, or the afternoon break.
And I think there was some suggestion in the record that the amount of time between breaks is about 90 minutes. Is that correct?
Approximately. It does vary. Obviously, it's a mid-morning break for the court reporter. They're entitled to it under their contract. So It does vary, but it's usually around that time, about 90 minutes, obviously, give or take 15 minutes. Usually it's taken at an appropriate time during a witness.
So we're talking segments of trial being about 1.5 to 2 hours, depending on how broad that 90 minute.
That's correct. To enforce this order, the district
court. Can I ask you a factual question? I'm not sure the parties agree about whether anyone actually was prevented from entering. Is there a dispute, I gather, on appeal as to whether the deputy actually turned someone away? From your brief, it seems like there's actually some attorneys from the defense side that were turned away.
Correct. I'll let Mr. Haas speak to his perspective on that, but It's fairly clear from the short evidentiary hearing that was held on the third day of trial that the deputy did not deny anyone access on the day 2 of trial, the afternoon, when the order was first in place. However, at the first sentencing hearing, it gets continued to when Mr. Aboukar is actually sentenced. The defense attorney does note that 2 of her attorneys were denied entry into the courtroom. Given the fact that we know it sounds like nobody was denied entry on the second day, that likely would have been the third day. I would note the third day of trial, I mean, started first thing in the morning and the verdicts were returned around 10 p.m. So obviously that's a large window there.
One other big picture question. I gather, if I'm reading correctly between the lines in your brief, that you believe that we're off on a wrong track because the Minnesota Supreme Court erroneously applies its trivial closure approach to the law.
I don't think trivial closures are something that's non-existent. They certainly are. I think the fear is how expansive they get.
Not the fear. I mean, I gather from your brief, you're arguing the Minnesota Supreme Court has erred, and with the cases that the parties are arguing about today.
I mean, I certainly would agree with, for instance, Justice Meyer's dissent in Brown or Justice Anderson's dissent. But I don't think that it's dispositive of this. I mean, if we apply the trivial closures that we have in Minnesota, this still goes well beyond that.
Well, aside from those facts, if you look at the the factors, and aside from the facts in those cases, if you just look at the factors that apply, you've got a pretty tough position, I think, correct?
So we get the factors from Lindsay, where really, I mean, the factors originated in Lindsay were just the facts that they found to be less serious.
Well, later in Brown, they were adopted as sort of the factors.
Correct. And then and it applied again in Silvernail a year later. But even here, like I say, I mean, if you look at those factors, I don't think the court considers them completely exhaustive, and certainly no single factor is dispositive of the analysis. So the first one being whether or not the courtroom was cleared of all spectators. Admittedly, that did not happen here. That would be a more egregious closure, certainly. I think everyone would agree with that. Whether the trial remained open to the press and the public, it was open to the people who were there, but obviously it's closed to any access from anyone who wanted to go into that trial while the trial was actually proceeding. The third factor being whether there were periods where members of the public were absent. Here again, we do have the two attorneys from the defense team that tried to get into the courtroom and were denied access. I think that is a crucial factor in this case. And then whether the defendant, defendant's family or friends, or any witnesses were.
And I'm sure that the third factor is when I look at the third Lindsay, we'll call it Lindsay factor, it's whether members of the public were absent, like somebody's there in the courtroom. And I thought throughout the trial, there was someone from the public present in the courtroom.
I guess, I mean, there were members present.
Right.
But I think even under the Lindsay factors, if someone was denied access, that would violate that prong. I mean, that's the point of it is, the point of public trials is to allow access.
I don't read it that way. I mean, the language that you use, certainly the Supreme Court could have said what you just described, which is individuals were actually turned away. I think the assumption is that individuals could be turned away if you're closing the courtroom, like in Brown or Lindsay or the other cases, for any period of time that people, I think the assumption is people are turned away. My point is, it doesn't feel like it should be a factual analysis. It's just as to what actually happened at the door. The question is whether the courtroom is closed or not.
I mean, I agree in terms of whether or not the Sixth Amendment trial right to a public trial is implicated is exactly what Your Honor is getting at, is whether or not the courtroom is simply closed. And that's clear in Waller. There is absolutely no discussion of anyone ever trying to get into that courtroom. The court doesn't care. It's whether or not you have the ability to get into the courtroom. And that's partly the purpose of public trials. One of the purposes that they always state is that it ensures that the attorneys, the prosecutor, the judges, that everyone is aware of their responsibility and their role, their obligations that they have in carrying out the criminal justice system that we have. And the fact that anyone could walk into any courtroom at any time kind of keeps everyone on their toes a little bit more. Similarly too, with witnesses. There's always a concern that witnesses will, or I think the hope from the case law is that witnesses will be more honest knowing that the courtroom is open. And again, at any time, someone could enter and essentially be a check on whether or not they're committing perjury.
But in Brown, so it doesn't matter really whether it's during the trial or during the instructions, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court's pretty clear. It's through
all phases.
All phases. So I'm having a hard time distinguishing this case from Brown, except for the number of segments. And is that something we need to look at if Brown establishes this rule by applying Lindsay that you can close a segment as long as you allow it to be open at the beginning, you don't kick anybody out of the courtroom. Applying the Lindsay factors, Supreme Court says that is something that falls into the trivial category. Why isn't it so here?
I think a few things. First of all, you look at, and it's not just Brown and Lindsay and Silvernail. I mean, really, if we kind of combine all of them, it's always one segment. It's a short segment. And every single case, they note that this was a isolated short segment in time of the trial. The other thing, too, I would note that in Silvernail, it was closing them during the prosecutor's closing arguments. In Brown, it was the jury instructions. That is not the evidence at trial. I think that there is a distinction there.
Is there? I thought this was sort of a bright line. Any proceeding, any part of the proceeding is public trial right, that's bright line, we're done. We don't have to decide whether there's a trial or evidence. It's the defendant wins if, in fact, there's a closure to the trial, I thought.
I mean, I certainly agree, but I'm just saying, I think from our Minnesota Supreme Court analysis, they do always emphasize the short time period that it was just during jury instructions to make sure the jury could understand the instructions, for instance. Those aren't in the Lindsay factors, but they highlighted in the case all the same. And I think it's different
here. If I understand it right, you would say, let's say this was the last segment of the trial, not early on. This was the court says, and during the last day, look, this is what we're going to do this afternoon. This afternoon, if you're here for the second segment when we start, you can stay. If you're not here, people aren't going to be allowed in, and it's only that segment. Would your argument be the same?
I think I'd have a much more difficult argument, because then there's almost no distinction between Brown or Silvernail at that point.
And that, I guess, goes to the heart of my question. It's really, if it's the number of segments that are where you have this rule, you have to come in at the beginning and you stay in to the end, then it seems like you would prevail. But if it's just the nature of the process, we're not going to allow you to come and go while the court's proceeding in business. You've got to come beforehand. Then I'm not sure your argument prevails. I'm just trying to see if there's some language in the cases that would support that theory, your position.
Well, I think part of the point there is, again, I acknowledge it's not in the Lindsay factors, but in Silvernail and in Brown, they always talk about how it was a limited closure for a short period of time. And that is important when you look at the federal case law on it, on trivial closures. The time of the closure is always very relevant to the court's analysis as to whether or not it was a trivial closure. Here, what we're getting at is the threshold question of whether or not his Sixth Amendment right to a public trial was implicated. And when you have over half the trial, I mean, they had a full day, you know, until 4:30 on day one that was open, voir dire, motions, one witness. And then they had half a day on the day two that was open. And then after lunch, the judge closes it. And it proceeds, it's during the victim's testimony, it's during several responding officers' testimony, it's during the closing arguments, it's during the jury instructions, it's during the questions that the jury asked and during the videos that they rewatched. It's significant portions of the trial, and that can't be ignored. I mean, that gets right at when we're implicating this trial right. I mean, as we say, part of the point is to make sure that the prosecutors are sharp and on their toes and aware of their responsibility, that the witnesses are aware. To close it down the way they did, if this does not implicate someone's Sixth Amendment public trial right, every single trial in the state of Minnesota could simply lock the doors every time they start and unlock them and it breaks, and that would be it. And it wouldn't implicate their trial right. They wouldn't have to make Waller findings. The judge could do it for no reason whatsoever. And that is not appropriate. We have public trial rights for a reason. And I understand here the court was frustrated by some distractions. I think it's a little overstated in the state's brief. The first time the judge even brings up distractions is on that second day after lunch, when she says, I'm going to, you know, put an armed deputy out in front of the courtroom and not allow anyone to come or go.
Is that when she said there's been no disruptions, just distractions?
At that point, she said that people were coming and going when the witnesses came and went. There had been two lay witnesses who had testified at that point. No indication of what those people were doing. I mean, I would submit that that is actually probably the most respectful time to leave a courtroom, is when there's a short break between a witness. But she said, no more of that, no more coming and going. We're going to close.
I guess I didn't read that in the I had the impression it was while witnesses were testifying, not they were coming and going in the breaks between witnesses. Did I misread the record?
So the first time it's brought up is on page 264 of the transcript. And that's where she says that as our lay witnesses were coming and going from the courtroom, there were members of the gallery who were also coming and going with those lay witnesses. That's her first stated reason. It comes up again. Then, you know, the next morning is the mistrial motion, which is denied prior to instructing the jury, but it was actually during a break. Someone clearly comes in and out of the courtroom, and the judge admonishes that person that they have to stay or go. That's on 394. Ends up being Mr. Abukar's mother, who doesn't speak English. But that was actually during a break. I mean, if you look at it, they take recess, and all of a sudden the court just comes back and says, you, ma'am, you got to stay or go. You can't do whatever. And then they say, okay. There is way later in the trial, after when the question is asked and they rewatch the videos, the judge indicates there that some people were talking while the evidence was being played. But at that point, we are over a day past when the court instituted its order. And that really gets to, I mean, how this was just not narrowly tailored. If you have distractions, and courts have the ability to control those within their...
Well, we only get to the narrow tailoring if
the right is implicated. Right. Correct. If the right is implicated. And we would hold here, I mean, again, without finding his rights being implicated, courts would simply be allowed to close for no reason. Thank you.
Good morning again, Mr. Haas.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. You know, I pointed to what I see as sort of the difference here in my questions about the standard of review, and maybe I invite guidance again from this court on that. And I pointed out that it's been very clear that trial courts have broad discretion to manage order and decorum in their courtroom.
In fact, are there any facts in dispute here? I mean, isn't it really a legal question as to whether or not there was a closure? In other words, the judge just saying I'm not closing the courtroom doesn't make it so.
Yes. I guess where I was maybe coming to the defense of is just present Minnesota case law that says before we even get to the question of whether the district court needed to make what we call the Waller factors, we have to determine if there was a closure in the first place. In other words, is this just a district court managing the routine day-to-day order and decorum of their courtroom, or do we have a closure?
Let's change the facts a little bit. Assume everything happened exactly as occurred in this case, except that instead of the judge saying, we're going to have, you can come and go during the mid-morning break, the lunch break, and the afternoon break, that we're just going to have trial all the way straight through. You've got to come at the beginning of the day. But if you're here at the beginning of the day, you can stay. You can pack the courtroom with everybody you want. Closure or no closure?
No closure.
That's not closure either?
Nope. And here's why I say that.
Is there a case anywhere that would suggest you've got some precedential support for that theory?
I am unaware of a fact pattern like that in the case law, Your Honor. But I guess on short notice, having answered my question, my response would be no, and here's why.
Okay.
The right to a public trial does not guarantee that everybody gets a seat in the courtroom. We just concluded a murder trial here this past week, relatively high profile case. And in cases like that, there are days when the courtroom's packed. There's just not a seat to be had. And at some point, the deputies say, I'm sorry, you just can't come in. And nowadays, maybe we might have remote ways of reviewing the trial, but historically, boy, if you weren't in the courtroom, well, you had to wait outside. So that's a public trial. And if a person showed up first thing in the morning and couldn't get a seat because they were just a little too slow and nobody relinquished their seat through the entire day as the fact pattern the court provided. And that unfortunate person, even a relative of the defendant, just couldn't get a seat. That defendant got a public trial. There were 50 people in the courtroom, not that one person perhaps, but it was a public trial in this context. So I would say under that circumstance, yeah, it could be a public trial. If the courtroom's full of people. So.
It would seem if that were so, then there would be a lot. Brown would have been a much shorter analysis.
I mean, it's not a fact pattern I would encourage. We certainly don't want to encourage courts to be, we want to facilitate and encourage a public trial. I think we all agree with that. And I guess what the fact pattern doesn't provide is there's some reason for it. You know, what you're not telling me is why did the court do that?
Let's assume it's for the same reason. Let's assume the judge says, look, I've handled a lot of these trials. It's distracting to the jury and the lawyers when people are coming and going. So here's what we're going to do. Show up at before 9 o'clock or, mm-hmm. you know, you have to come back the next day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, again, if you had a full packed courtroom and every seat was taken throughout the entire day, is it not a public trial? I mean, I go back to the factors in the case law from Lindsay and that. I mean, was the courtroom cleared of all spectators? That's the number one first case. That's a closure. By the way, we do closures regularly in almost every criminal sexual conduct case, particularly ones dealing with child victims. We don't expect jurors to confess for the first time to reveal that they were a victim of child sexual abuse in a public forum. And we have a standard template order the judges sign every time, effectively listing the Waller factors. So it's not as though we don't have closures. We do.
That's what I was just going to raise. I mean, we don't do, typically the Waller factors are analyzed before there is a closure.
Typically.
And here, well, let me step back a minute. I think Judge Ross asked if there was a fact dispute here as to whether or not people were able to get into the courtroom, defense counsel that wanted to get into the courtroom, or part of the defense team. Can you address that question? Mm-hmm.
There was an evidentiary hearing, actually, where the deputy testified, and there was actually an exhibit received by the court. I don't have access to that. It was actually the security videos. Now, I think you all have it. I don't have access to it. But that was received by the court. It was at the sentencing hearing later where Ms. Martinez just stated for the court that she alleged that two of her colleagues wanted to come and see the trial and were denied entry. There was no testimony to that. It was a statement of counsel. She said they will submit affidavits later. I don't believe those affidavits were ever submitted or received by the court. So the extent of that evidence, if you call it that, was the assertion of defense counsel at the sentencing hearing. So that's the extent that I'm aware of anyone, but the deputy.
But when I look at other cases, the question of whether the courtroom was closed does not depend on, I mean, the question just hangs on the simple doors were closed. No one was going to be allowed. The case law, federal included, seems not to base the idea of closure, the conclusion of closure, on whether or not someone is actually turned away. The court just says, no one's going to be permitted to come in. That's all you have to show. So why would it matter that defense counsel was turned away if they would have been turned away? Doesn't that make the court, doesn't the question of closure hang on that?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. All I can do is say
from the case law. Have you found any case law where
I would say no? It says, well, did the judge clear it? Said everybody out. Did they clear the courtroom of spectators? Everybody's got to go except the parties and the judge. Was it open to the public and press? That kind of hinges on the first one. In our case, again, nobody was asked to leave. And in fact, we know it's a very public trial because Judge Daly was really, you know, struggling, trying to maintain order in the courtroom. Repeatedly, she kept bringing it up. She was directly admonishing people in the gallery. This wasn't an empty courtroom by any stretch. In fact, it was these.
I don't recall the record reflecting that she asked particular individuals to leave.
No, she didn't eject any individuals.
And instead, she imposed an order or that people couldn't come and go unless they were all, you know, except during breaks, basically.
Yeah, correct. She did not affirmatively eject any individual from the courtroom. But I think you can.
So if her concern was chatter in the courtroom, closing the door to anybody coming in after the break wouldn't have had any effect on that. That's really the justification or the rationale of closing the court. That doesn't seem to correlate to the actual act of what the court did.
Well, yes, that's another disruptive behavior. But one of the behaviors that the district court referred to on numerous occasions was the manner in which people just getting up, coming and going, and it was during testimony, during the presentation of evidence. So that was the part of it that caused her to say, people are just going to do that during the scheduled breaks. And yeah, it was part of her frustration was people's behavior in the courtroom, but they continued that, as I read it, to be chattering and interacting as they were going in and out of the courtroom as well. So not only while they were seated, but their behavior following their entry and exit from the courtroom was part of that.
So is it your view that let's call them the Lindsay factors are determinative as to whether or not a closure was trivial?
Yes.
No other considerations, it's not come into play.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say they're an exclusive list. I think this court can take into account other contexts, but this is the guidance we have from our Supreme Court as to whether there was a closure at all.
Also, can you address counsel's argument that Silvernail, Brown, all of those cases, again, there was a small period of time of closure, whether it was voir dire or whether or not it was a small hearing. In this case, half the trial was restricted. Does that play into our analysis as to whether or not this was a trivial closing?
Well, I guess I reject the characterization that half the trial, you know, this length of trial, it kind of goes to, I think, Judge Ross's scenario. I would argue that the clock starts over once you have a break. There was a period of time, an hour and a half, whatever it is, 2 hours, where there was no access denied. Then there was a break. And anyone that was waiting to come in was allowed to come in. I would suggest that the clock starts over. It's a series of short restrictions, but it's not. I think the scenario that would be more of what Judge Ross suggested, that no one could come in.
If the issue was disruptive behavior, then wouldn't the judge need to, in each of these short period of closures, as you're saying, so you're having closure, court opening, closure, need to, again, either make Lindsay factors as to why it should continue to be closed, or are you saying at the very beginning of a series of short closures, you make the Lindsay factor, and regardless of whether or not this behavior is still happening, it just remains closed?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with the term closure. This, the way you framed it was closure, break, closure. What I'm arguing is none of that was a closure. There were restrictions placed.
Well, you're saying it was a trivial closure, is what
maybe
that'd
be a better term. Yeah, certainly a restriction. If a trivial closure probably would be the right nomenclature.
Isn't there a cumulative effect? I mean, you have then, in your view, numerous trivial closures, but cumulatively, doesn't that have the effect of denying defendant the right to a public trial, such that the closures are not trivial when looked at together?
I mean, I guess maybe I could probably conceive of a fact pattern that might give rise to that conclusion. That's not ours, is my position here, is that it's, this was a very live courtroom during this trial. They were definitely spectators.
What if you had a week-long murder trial? Well, that's not a murder trial, because a week-long trial that wasn't super high profile, but it was a week-long trial, and the same restrictions were in place throughout the entire trial. Would that be a trivial closure?
Well, I guess I would go back to the factors. Was the courtroom clear to spectators, or did you have a packed courtroom watching it? You know, that would be the factors I would apply. Whether some people couldn't get a seat or not, I don't think is determinative. Was the press there?
What I think the record reflects that, you know, there was an individual who needed to leave to go to work, who was in the courtroom, and that individual was concerned about whether they would be able to leave. I mean, couldn't these small trivial closures, as you call them, have the effect of denying public access because they can't come and go as they need to both be at the trial and get to work?
Well,
in other words, imposing this sort of restriction might have prevented someone from coming in the first place because they knew they couldn't leave when they needed to leave.
It might have restrained that person, but it did it restrain the public? Did it restrain the other 50 people that were in the courtroom? You know, I guess I still come back to the Lindsay factors as to whether we even get to the Waller factors, which, by the way, if we do, I think our appellate courts are clear. Send it back to Judge Daly and have her apply those factors if you think it's a closure. Our position is, as the district court said, this is just not a closure. If it is, it's a trivial closure.
Well, the court kept saying that it's not a closure, right. But the court can't magically say we're locking the door, but it's not locked. Nobody can come in either. I think that's a question of law, whether it's closed or not.
I don't disagree. No. My time is coming to a close. I appreciate the questions, and it's a really interesting discussion to have. This is going to be remanded to correct some sentencing errors, and I had invited some guidance with respect to the question of can a person be convicted of first-degree burglary based on assault?
If I could just throw in one more question on sentencing since you raised it. The argument that you raise on sentencing, is that an issue that the district court decided? It seems like you're saying, well, okay, Hernandezing, that's an error, but, you know, we've got a no harm, no foul because of this other issue. Was that issue raised properly before us on appeal?
No, it was not raised at the district court at all. I'm just as a practical matter noting that there were errors in the Hernandezing that we have to fix. And as I pointed out, may I finish the question?
You may.
I'm sorry. What I point out in my brief is that the original sentencing worksheet, from our perspective, was correct. It was burglary, 2 points, domestic assault, 2 points. Then it went to the next burglary, now with 4 points, and then the domestic assault with 4 points. Our position is that's the correct offenses to be sentenced and the correct order and the correct points. I think counsel and I, we all agree on the number of points that there ought to be. We agree that there needs to be some things vacated and changed. But I think that had the district court not misread Holmes and said, well, it might have brought us back on track. We'll sort it out at the district court here, but to the extent that it seems like this question has come up, and it's a Saletto case that I cited, that's a fairly recent case. Another court, I think, had made that. It would be helpful, I just say, if the court might, again, restate this holding that was in Saletto, that yes, burglary assault, the other crime to burglary assault can be, doesn't have to be, but it can be a domestic assault because the variances in the elements. That's all I was asking for some guidance on. But the district court can do what they want so long as it's, I'll conclude there, and I appreciate your questions and respectfully, we'll deal with some of these things on remand.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with addressing some of the hypotheticals that were discussed. A closed courtroom does not mean an empty courtroom. The respondent just said that if someone, you know, was turned away, that you would have to look at the Lindsay factors to figure it out if it's closed because it might have been close to that person, but not to the public. That's completely inaccurate, and it's well throughout our case law. If you exclude a person or group of people, whatever it might be, that is a closure. Federally, they call it partial closures. Some courts use a different standard, but it is still a closure. And that's what we've had in Minnesota. I'm going to probably mispronounce it, but McCuck, which is cited in my brief, M-A-H-K-U-K. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2007. It involves a defendant's brother and cousin being excluded, and it was remanded because the court did not make adequate findings. Caldwell is a case where defendant's mother was excluded for being repeatedly disruptive. That was affirmed. They said it was fine given her conduct and everything, but it is still treated as closures, even when one person is excluded, because that's the point of a public trial, is that the public or anyone has access to our courts. They can at any time come into court. During the first argument today, a colleague of mine came in during appellant's responsive argument. It's public. Anyone can do it. We could do it at this hearing, you can do it at a bail hearing, and everywhere in between. That's the point of a public trial right.
So can you address the question of whether we should look at the periods of closure cumulatively or individually?
I think you have to look at them cumulatively because that was the closure. It's for the rest of this trial, here's what's happening. And does that implicate his Sixth Amendment right, the right to have public access to your trial? And again, I think if you look at the case law, I think it's very clear. And Judge Ross, I think, has hit it a few times, both with me initially and then with respondents' argument as well, that it's a matter of access. It doesn't matter if someone shows up, but if someone were to show up, do they have access to that courtroom? Is it a public hearing? And you know, it might be disruptive sometimes. Trial courts can be that way. It's something you deal with. And if it was an issue, the judge could have brought it up while it was happening, said, please don't do that. Please come and go without causing disruptions, whatever it might be. I mean, that's the power a judge has to have some, you know, decorum in their courtroom. And if it becomes an issue, then you maybe get to exclude that person, like Caldwell, but you have to make the appropriate findings. I mean, and that's really the question here is if it raises to implicate a Sixth Amendment right, it's whether or not the findings were sufficient. And here, they simply weren't.
So, assuming we were to agree that there was a closure, why wouldn't we remand back to the district court to consider the Waller factors?
So, if you look at
the Waller findings,
if you look at the Waller factors and the findings there, the crux of it is really what is the court doing and why are they doing? They have to identify an overriding interest. They have to then narrowly tailor the closure to serve that interest, consider reasonable alternatives, and then make appropriate findings. I mean, so first of all, even right there, the court just didn't do that. They didn't make the appropriate findings. But more importantly, we have in the record what the court did, why they were doing it. The interest that is identified is disruptive behavior of people coming and going during witnesses. I don't think that's an overriding interest. To the extent disruptions in the courtroom can get to an overriding interest, it never was. And the respondent spends a lot of time pointing out how many times the judge brought this up, but she actually doesn't bring it up that frequently. She brings it up when she first institutes the order, the second day on the lunch break, and then once during the jury's questions to watch the video.
I assume you agree that if the judge is concerned about chattering going on during the proceedings isn't relevant to the decision to close the court.
Exactly. I mean, the thing here is, if there was chatter during the videos, for instance, during the jury questions, you know, the judge might be within her right to kick those people out, almost certainly. As a former prosecutor, I'd agree. But she closes it on day two, right after lunch, without ever even warning anyone, hey, calm down. I mean, it's nothing. It's just straight to closure. And here's what I'm doing. Here's why I'm doing it. That does not satisfy the Waller factors. There's no remand that's going to cure this defect. Because the interest itself of disruption is clearly just not met, and at least not until maybe when the video is being played late on day three.
Knowing, as I'm sure you do, that we're not going to reverse Lindsay or Brown, but obviously you would like us to distinguish those cases. What is the rule of law that would allow us to rule in your favor in light of Brown?
I think if there was just a one sentence distinction between the line of cases that we have and what we have here, is that in those cases, Silvernail, Brown, it was a short period of time, a very short closure. Whereas here, it was a large swath of the trial, including evidence from the victim, officers, evidence being played, just so much more substantial trial rights that are implicated where the public was denied access. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The arguments here were very well done, and the briefing was helpful. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.